Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes has arrived in IMAX.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Over on Patreon.com, we have got a lot of new exclusive Bowery Boys audio for our super fans, including, of course, our regular Patreon-only show called Side Streets.
And at the $5.5 level and above, I've got a whole episode of bonus scenes from my recent Stories of Flushing show, with many more interesting bits of history. Then at the $10 Gilded Age level, you'll get audio from my interview with author Eric J. Dolan, recorded at the New York Historical Society. We're talking privateers, pirates, and the American Revolution.
And that's not all. At that same level, you also get exclusive merchandise, new shows a couple of days before everybody else, and you get all of our podcasts ad-free.
You won't even hear this message. That's all on patreon.com/Bowery Boys.
Your support helps us keep the show running. Thank you so much.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. You've probably heard of HIIT, High Intensity Interval Training. In fact, you may feel so familiar with the idea that you think you understand it. But do you? People often hold some popular misconceptions about HIIT, and today we'll unpack what some of those are with Dr. Martin Gabala, a foremost researcher of this fitness modality and the author of The 1 Minute Workout. Science shows a way to get fit that's smarter, faster, shorter. Martin explains the main, underappreciated advantage of HIIT, which revolves around the intensity-duration trade-off. The higher intensity you make exercise, the shorter your workouts can be, while still triggering improvements in metabolism, cardiovascular health, and mitochondrial capacity. We get into the fact that the intensity of HIIT needn't be as high as you might think, and that, contrary to popular belief, sprinting at intervals is actually a predominantly aerobic rather than anaerobic workout. Martin answers questions like whether Zone 2 cardio has an advantage over HIIT, if the so-called afterburn effect of HIIT is real, if you can do HIIT if you're older or have heart problems, and whether you should worry about the way HIIT can raise cortisol in the body. He also shares specific HIIT workouts you can do, including a walking interval workout and one of the best higher intensity protocols to try. After the show's over, check out our show notes at awim.is/HIIT, and that's HIIT. All right, Martin Gabala, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you are a professor of kinesiology at McMaster University in Canada, and you spent a lot of your career researching high-intensity interval training, or HIIT. I'm curious, what led you down that path?
Yeah, sort of a personal and professional interest. The personal interest is when I first got to McMaster, I was a busy young assistant professor, had a working spouse, two young kids at the time. And so, you know, quite ironically, for a professor of exercise physiology, I found myself with very little time to exercise. And that dovetailed with a professional interest. For a long time, I've taught a fourth-year course called the Integrative Physiology of Human Performance. And my students are always interested in the training regimes of high-level athletes. And so I would ask them, you know, why do these elite endurance athletes sprint? Why do they run hard or do these short, intense workouts to enhance their aerobic performance? And so it was those combination of things that led me down this path.
I think everyone at this point has probably heard of high intensity interval training, or HIIT. I mean, it really had a moment. I mean, this is about when your book came out, The 1 Minute Workout came out, and you wrote some articles for the New York Times, like went viral. Like you could just do a short workout, really intense, and get all these benefits. But I think when most people think of HIIT, and I know I did this before I read your book, they typically think it's got to be a boot camp style, super intense CrossFit workout of the day type workout. But one of the points you make in the book is that idea of HIIT, while that is HIIT, that idea of HIIT is too narrow. So how do you define high intensity interval training?
Yeah, absolutely. And for sure, this idea that you need to go all out or as hard as you can go, that's a big misconception. Certainly, that's one type of high intensity interval training, but it's not the only type. And so to me, HIIT is very simply alternating bouts of relatively hard work and recovery periods. Now, high intensity, we can generally equate that with vigorous intensity effort, you know, as compared to light or moderate. And there's well-defined metrics in physical activity, exercise, prescription guidelines for what constitutes vigorous intensity. So if you can imagine a simple 10-point subjective scale where one is laying on the couch or complete sedentariness and 10 is sprint from danger pace or save your child from an oncoming car, vigorous exercise or HIIT is about a 7. It roughly corresponds to about 80% of maximal heart rate. And for an athlete, it means the severe intensity domain, and we use other metrics such as critical power, critical speed. But key point here is that it is not only all-out exercise. Absolute intensity can vary dramatically between individuals, but the relative intensity can be quite similar.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. What constitutes intensity is going to vary from person to person. So someone who's super fit, CrossFitter type guy, what that person has to do to get to a high enough intensity to have a high intensity interval training workout, it's going to be different from someone who hasn't worked out or exercised in 30 years. And their intensity might just be they get up off the couch and they walk briskly for a little bit. That's going to be intense for them.
Absolutely. There's a figure I like to show in presentations to different stakeholders, and it's two heart rate tracings from two individuals on very far ends of the fitness spectrum. And the top heart rate tracing is from an Olympic athlete, and the bottom tracing is from an individual with coronary heart disease. But they're both doing the same interval training workout normalized to them. They're both doing 4-minute intervals at about 90% of their maximal heart rate. Now, of course, the Olympic athlete is working at a very high pace. And as you alluded to, the deconditioned patient is hardly doing much more than a walk or a brisk walk. But it really is a dramatic illustration of this notion that, you know, we can really scale absolute intensity to elicit the same relative stimulus, even if people are on very far ends of the fitness spectrum.
Okay, so another important part of HIIT is the interval part. So it's not just you're going hard for as long as you can. The idea is that you take a break from it every now and then go back up. So you're trying to create just this wave of extremes in your workout.
That's right. We talk about hills and valleys. And, you know, going back to athletes, you know, a common refrain is make your hard days hard and your easy days easy. And so it's the same notion, right? And those recovery periods are very, very important in order that you can go hard in the subsequent intervals. But this undulating pattern is intrinsic to the method.
Okay. So basically, HIIT is alternating higher intensity bouts of exercise with lower intensity in the same session. And you're alternating because you can't stay very high intensity for long. I mean, the idea is, and we're going to talk about this more as we go along, but by ramping up the intensity, just a few short bouts of exercise can give you a lot of the benefits, just like longer sessions of exercise, but in a shorter amount of time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the underlying physiology is the same. You know, your body really does. There's an old saying that your heart doesn't know what your muscles are doing. It just, you know, realizes it's some sort of physiological stress or challenge. And what we're finding is that, you know, intensity really plays a key. And so we can definitely trigger responses through traditional moderate intensity continuous training, relatively high volume. But many of those hallmark adaptations, it seems we can trigger with a surprisingly small dose of the vigorous intensity work as well.
So while HIIT really burst on the scene, I'd say, you know, the middle of the 2000s, early 2010s, one thing you do in your book is that you highlight that athletes and other professions like the military as well, they were using HIIT without even knowing they're using HIIT to get in better shape.
Yeah, absolutely. So athletes tended to perform high volume, high intensity interval training. And so there's very famous examples of people like Paavo Nurmi, Emil Zatopek. These were Olympic champions in multiple events. And for example, legend had it that Zatopek sometimes completed 15 miles a day of intervals as 200 and 400 meter repeats. So at these very, very high volume protocols. But also there were individuals like Roger Bannister, who famously trained with intervals on his lunch hour when he was a very busy medical student running repeats on a quarter mile track.
And then you also highlight, I thought it was interesting, the Canadian it was the Air Force or the, it was one of the military units in Canada. They this guy stumbled upon HIIT and he used it to help get new recruits in shape.
That's right. One of the first exercise physiologists was hired by the Canadian military at sort of the height of the Cold War, because at one time, you can imagine these service members stationed in very remote outposts, you know, literally near the North Pole. And at one time, so many Air Force pilots were unfit. About a third were deemed unfit to fly on missions. And so the government realized they had to do something about it. But, you know, you're stationed in the far north, not a lot of specialized equipment. You don't want to be outside very much. And so they came up with this plan called 5BX, which stood for five basic exercises. And sort of the tagline was you could get fit with these simple bodyweight style exercises. It only took about 11 minutes a day. And this spread well beyond the military. And eventually about 20 million of these pamphlets were distributed to Canadian households in the early 1960s. There was an equivalent plan for women called XBX. But again, it was this idea that you could get fit, didn't have to be fancy, didn't require a lot of time, but it was based on this idea of, you know, getting up to a vigorous pace in order to stress the cardiovascular system.
Well, we've been talking about you can use HIIT to get fit, I mean, increase fitness. Let's talk about what we mean by fitness. And in the book, you talk about there's, you know, we have different systems in our body, the anaerobic system and the aerobic system. How does HIIT make us more fit? We're doing a lot of rhyming here. How does HIIT make us more fit, both anaerobically and aerobically? And I guess we'd have to explain what the anaerobic systems are and the aerobic systems are for those who aren't familiar with it. Let's start there.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically two ways of generating energy within the body. And so aerobic means requiring oxygen. So you can imagine we literally are burning fuels such as sugars and fats using molecular oxygen to produce energy. And so very much like a fire, you know, you need wood for the fire. That's the glucose or fatty acid molecules. You need oxygen and you need the spark as well to keep the fire going. Now, we can also produce some energy without the use of oxygen. And so this is the notion of anaerobic or non-oxidative energy. And you could think of a spectrum or a continuum rather, where the aerobic system is great in terms of capacity, very high overall amounts of energy, but it comes at a cost of it's slower. And so non-oxidative or anaerobic energy, it doesn't require oxygen. It's very, very fast in terms of the rate at which it produces energy, but its capacity is very, very limited. And so for a long time, it was thought, or you still hear this very commonly today, that HIIT is anaerobic exercise. And again, very much a misnomer. Any type of repeated sprint is primarily fueled by the aerobic or oxidative energy supply system. And so, you know, you can think of team sports or that. But repeated sprints, very much an aerobic stress. And so it's not surprising then that we see these profound responses within the aerobic energy supply system. You know, even during a 30-second, as hard as you can go, all-out sprint, about 20% of the energy is coming from aerobic metabolism. And then when you do repeated 30-second all-out sprints, the predominant energy providing system is aerobic metabolism.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, yeah, I've heard that same thing, that sprinting is an anaerobic metabolic conditioning. And if you wanted to get aerobic conditioning, you have to do the more steady state cardio. What do you think is going on there? You know, like, why does that idea still exist that sprinting only engages the anaerobic system when sprinting at intervals, at least, you're actually engaging the aerobic system too?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt, you know, if you want to become a better sprinter, you better sprint train, right? And so sprint training, it will definitely stimulate non-oxidative energy metabolism and again, literally make you a better sprinter and develop those enzymes and that supply method. It's a fact that when you do a single sprint, most of the energy is anaerobic, but again, it's very, very different when we do these repeated sprints. And so I'm not really sure why that endures so much, or we use these terms like aerobic and anaerobic. And, you know, another misconception is that we only utilize one system or the other. We're very much, you know, virtually every type of exercise that we do, whether it lasts a few seconds or many, many hours, there's always going to be some blend or some contribution for both of those main systems. And really it's whatever system predominates. But again, suffice to say, repeated sprints, very potent aerobic stimulus. And you know, that's associated with a wide array of health benefits as well when we develop the aerobic supply system.
So what are the aerobic responses our body has when we take part in repetitive sprinting at intervals?
Yeah, probably the biggest one is cardiorespiratory fitness. And, you know, that's that notion of cardio health. It's largely determined by the capacity of your heart, your blood vessels to circulate oxygen through the body. We measure that clinically or in a laboratory with a maximal oxygen uptake test. So that's a VO2 max test. That's clearly very important for athletes, but there's very strong and compelling epidemiological evidence to show that having a higher cardiorespiratory fitness is associated with a lower risk of dying from all causes, a lower risk of developing many different chronic conditions like cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes. And so any way that we can enhance our cardiorespiratory fitness is really, really important. So you can sort of think of your cardiorespiratory fitness as the ceiling, right? And we want our ceiling to be as high as possible. And then the other aspect to fitness is metabolic fitness, and that's largely determined by our muscles. And that sort of regulates how close to the ceiling you can work for a prolonged period of time or your resistance to fatigue. And so, you know, athletes want high cardiorespiratory fitness and a high metabolic fitness. They want a big ceiling and they want to be able to work close to that for a long time. But it's, again, the underlying physiology is the same. And so individuals who are very deconditioned, they often have low ceilings, but they have a very low percentage of the ceiling that they can work at as well. And so any type of exercise training will tend to enhance both of those things. But again, we've learned that the vigorous intensity intermittent exercise can be, you know, we talk about an efficient way to train. What that really means is there's some time efficiency there and we can get away with less total time and probably exercise and still get to a similar level of improvement.
Yeah. So you could do an hour of steady state cardio and get, you know, X amount of benefits in terms of VO2 max or increase in mitochondria in your cells, or you could do a 10-minute high intensity interval training and get roughly the same benefits. Is that the pitch, the sales pitch?
Yeah, no, it is, right? And, you know, arguably we should do both. And, you know, you very much see these arguments where people will try to demonize traditional cardio, or now there's sort of a pushback against HIIT. And I don't really have a ton of time for those, try to say what is the best type. Again, I think, at least from our research, what we've been trying to do, we talk about expanding the movement menu, which really means, you know, we've largely been telling people to do the same thing for a long time, and that's fine. The physical activity guidelines are based on excellent science, but we know a lot of people aren't listening, right? And one of the perceived barriers, whether it's real or not, is a perceived lack of time, or people think, oh, if I don't have an hour in the day, I'm going to blow off my workout. And I think what the interval training literature is showing is, you know what, you don't need a whole lot of time and still get some bang for your buck there. And really, that's been a focus or through line of our research is, you know, trying to establish the scientific credibility of these brief, vigorous type workouts. And then, you know, hopefully presenting that as an option to people. We're not saying it's the only work that you should do, or, you know, if you don't like interval training, okay, that's fine. Go do the moderate stuff. But trying to expand that movement menu, give people more physical activity options, just like we try to give options for dietary strategies, you know, pick the food you like. You can sort of pick the exercise approaches that you like, because the best one is what you enjoy. You're more likely to stick with it over the long term.
It seems like people keep rediscovering HIIT or interval training, you know, every 10 years or so. You see this in the fitness industry. You'll see these trends where like, oh, it's steady state cardio. Like, no. We're going to do HIIT now. HIIT's the best thing in the world. Like, no, actually, it's steady state cardio. Because I think in the past 5 years, I've seen a lot of talk about zone two cardio, where it's, you know, you want to stay in zone two for 60 minutes and get so much of it a week. And I've been doing that. I've enjoyed it. It allows me to watch movies and television shows that I don't otherwise wouldn't watch. But I think what your research is showing is that there's nothing wrong with zone two cardio. It's very healthy for you. But if you don't have time, HIIT might be an option for you.
No, agree. And so, you know, I think some of the, and you're right, you know, these things come in and out of fashion a little bit, but I think some of the pushback against HIIT comes certainly from some overstatement regarding potential benefits of HIIT, you know, hopefully not from our laboratory or interviews like this, but definitely, you know, you see some overstatement, you can get away with a few minutes a week and, you know, that's the solution for fitness. Or so when we start saying, you know, this is the solution to our inactivity problem, or this is the best way to exercise or the optimal approach, I think that's where it becomes problematic. You know, to my mind, the rise of zone two is owing in part to that's how high level endurance athletes train in terms of roughly an 80-20 split. So if you're a high-level endurance athlete, you know, training 25, 30 hours a week, there's very good evidence to show that they tend to center around this 80% low intensity, 20% high intensity, much of that being intervals. And so, you know, it's interesting because classically, zone two has meant the heavy intensity domain. And this is where there's a classic three zone training model for athletes. But, you know, now zone two has commonly been interpreted as low intensity, sub-lactate threshold based training. And you're right, you know, it's definitely can be beneficial. You know, I'm unconvinced, or I just don't see the data that zone two is best to optimize your mitochondrial capacity. There's many different ways to do that. And so I think, again, ideally, we should train across a range of intensities. But I'd come back to this idea that I think as volume decreases, intensity is arguably more important. And so where I would take some exception to the commentators is suggesting that because athletes who do 25 hours a week train this way, that's how everyone else should exercise. You know, regular people who might have an hour a week or, you know, 2 hours a week to exercise, or maybe they only have 20 minutes that they're willing to do. I think there, doing anything is clearly better than nothing. But engaging in a more vigorous effort, again, not necessarily all out, it's better bang for your buck, certainly, given the time investment.
Yeah, I know I made a big emphasis on zone two starting 2 years ago because the sales pitch on, it helped increase the amount of mitochondria in your cells. I was like, well, that sounds like it's important. And so I'm doing 2 to 3 hours a week on the elliptical, watching Cobra Kai on YouTube, but I'd have days where I couldn't get a session in, a zone two session. It's like, man, it's an hour. I don't have an hour. And so I just wouldn't work out. It's like, well, I'm not going to get that mitochondria that I need. But then after I read your book, this happened to me last week. I didn't have time. I had literally had 15 minutes. So I just got on my Airdyne bike, the fan bike, and I did a interval thing. I was like, hey, I got it in. I got some of those aerobic benefits from doing that 10-minute interval training workout.
Fantastic, right? And that's the key takeaway, I think, is lots of different options, even for a given individual. You know, I'm a committed exerciser to this approach. Well, if I can't do my approach on that day, maybe I'm going to try something different. And so again, vary it up. And, you know, to your point, when time is pressed, maybe engage in some of the vigorous stuff. And even if only you do it for 5 or 10 minutes, know that you're still getting some benefit there, at least to maintain your fitness, you know, until you can get back to your regular routine.
Okay, so HIIT, you can get the same aerobic benefits as doing the long and slow and steady cardio. I think that's good to know. You talk about how it can improve our cardiovascular health, reduce our risk of heart attacks, heart disease. You also talk about how HIIT can help improve or manage diabetes and insulin resistance. What does your research say there?
Yeah. And so again, I want to really emphasize here, any type of exercise can do these things, right? And so these are not necessarily exclusive benefits to HIIT, but certainly some evidence from our laboratory, a lot of other laboratories shows that HIIT can improve measures of insulin sensitivity or blood sugar control. And so part of the reason for that is that, you know, we have in our body these things called glucose transporters. They're in all of our tissues, but they're responsible for sort of moving the glucose molecules or the sugar out of the bloodstream into our cells, where it can be taken up and stored or used for energy. And so exercise generally, and in particular vigorous exercise, enhances the capacity for glucose transport. And so that's likely one of the reasons that blood sugar control can be managed a little bit better. Or certainly if you're an individual with type 2 diabetes and you engage in regular exercise, one of the things that you'll find is your physician is going to say, well, you need less of your medication because the exercise is doing that for you. And so we don't now need to give you drugs or as many drugs in order to try and regulate your blood sugar, because you're sort of doing it on your own through physical activity.
Another benefit I've seen touted for HIIT is weight loss, this idea of the afterburner effect. What does the research say about that? Is that legit?
Yeah, Definitely something to it. Again, it's one of these things I think that's often overstated. And so, you know, you look online and you might see someone's comparing an interval versus a traditional cardio workout and see this massive afterburn effect. It's definitely real. So this idea of a heightened metabolic rate in recovery, you have this transiently higher calorie burn, and it can add up over time. So people say, you know, how can HIIT, especially if it's short, result in any calorie burning at all? Well, it does relate to this idea of the afterburn effect. But again, it's relatively small and we shouldn't overstate it. And, you know, HIIT can play a role in weight management efforts, just like other types of exercise. But, you know, the nutrition side of the equation is the primary driver there.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you always struggled with finding time to manage your finances? At the end of a busy week, the last thing you want to do is spend time budgeting all of your expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions you no longer use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. My favorite feature on Rocket Money is finding those unwanted subscriptions. If you're like me, you have a bunch of those things you signed up for but forgot about, streaming services, newsletters, maybe some fitness plans. You just connect your account to the app, Rocket Money finds the recurring subscription fees, and then you can easily cancel them from the app. It's a really cool service. They also have a service that can help you lower your bill. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. That's a lot of money. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to, you know, set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. There have been a lot of amazing people as guests on this podcast, but what if you want to go deeper? If you're looking somewhere to learn from the most remarkable people, that's Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 200 classes to pick from, with new classes added every month, and they have over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. For example, Chris Voss has a class on negotiation, Jocko Willink has a class on leadership, and Malcolm Gladwell has a class on writing. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. One class that I've really enjoyed is the one with Chris Voss on negotiation. My favorite lesson in that class was the lesson on tactical empathy, something we talked about in the podcast that we did with him a long time ago, but he goes in deeper with this. And besides just the lectures, you get exercises so you can actually put this stuff into practice. Right now, listeners will get an additional 15% off annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. masterclass.com/AOM. And now back to the show. Okay, so HIIT can improve our aerobic capacity. It can improve our cardiovascular health, can help with insulin sensitivity, with weight loss. How much HIIT do you have to do to get these benefits? Like, how long do the sessions need to be? And like, how many sessions do you have to do before you start seeing these benefits? Have you guys looked at that?
Yeah, we have. And so definitely the responses, the adaptations, they can occur surprisingly quickly. So we're talking within a week or two. You know, we've done a study, for example, in older, overweight individuals with type 2 diabetes, and we put them on a HIIT protocol that was only 6 sessions over 2 weeks. And even after 2 weeks, we saw marked improvements in some of those things that I was talking about, their glucose transport capacity, some markers of blood sugar control. So the responses can occur very quickly, and probably the more deconditioned you are, the faster the response is. You know, you probably have a lot more room to improve. And we've got to be careful there, because, you know, we're not saying to these people that, especially if you're very deconditioned, HIIT does not mean jumping off the couch and pedaling your heart out on a bike. It's just, you know, getting out of your comfort zone, going a little harder than you may have before. So it definitely can occur quickly. In terms of how long the sessions have to be, again, this is where it really comes back to what's the intensity. And so there's many different HIIT protocols, but certainly 10-minute total time commitment involving, you know, 1 to 2 minutes of vigorous intensity exercise can be enough if you do that over a few weeks to start to see measurable improvements in various health and fitness markers.
And just to recap, the intensity we're going for is on a scale of 1 to 10. 7 is about what we want to HIIT.
That's right. 7 out of 10 is that vigorous range. And obviously, you know, and for reference there, a traditional moderate intensity would be about a 5 on that range to help people try and scale it.
How do people typically feel when they're at a 7? It's just like you're breathing really heavy, you're sweating. Like, what are some of the physiological responses?
Yeah. And so one of the classic ones is, you know, moderate exercise being that 5, you could carry on a conversation or you could talk in sentences, but you wouldn't want to sing. Whereas if you're into that vigorous range, you know, you can grunt out a few words, but you really don't want to speak in sentences or have a conversation. So there's sort of, that's what we're talking about there in terms of these subjective cues to know you might be in the right range. The interesting thing is, especially with the shorter the intervals, some of these traditional metrics, whether it's heart rate or relative to VO2 max or heart rate reserve, they don't seem to align as well. And so, you know, if we're talking 20, 30 second efforts, people can go at a surprisingly high pace, but they don't perceive it as such because the effort is over quite quickly. And so it's a real challenge, frankly, in terms of trying to apply some of these brief, vigorous protocols widely and try to translate this into exercise prescription for people, because a lot of the metrics that we normally use don't necessarily apply. But, you know, this idea of perceived exertion, that 0 to 10 scale, it's probably about the best we have in terms of applying this widely and in a way that people can understand.
And then what your research has shown, the higher you go up in intensity, the shorter the duration can be. Is that correct?
Yeah. You know, there's clearly an intensity duration trade-off. It's not necessarily linear either. It's almost exponential. So as the intensity really gets up there, the dose that you need, the volume or the time that you need can really, really drop off. And there's, you know, some very clear research to show that.
Does HIIT affect men and women any differently, or is it the same?
Yeah, so there's definitely some differences related to biological sex, but they appear to be quite subtle. There's a much greater range or scale for just fundamental inter-individual differences between humans, but some of our work, some research from others has shown, you know, subtle differences. And, you know, you can point to some underlying biological variables there, maybe related to hormone concentration or the estrogens that could potentially impact on this from a mechanistic basis. But again, suffice to say, a little bit of evidence, maybe females don't have as pronounced a cardiovascular response as males. But again, I think that's more related to just inter-individual differences between humans, or that's much broader. And clearly, both men and women can benefit from interval training and benefit from, you know, many different types of exercise.
What about age and HIIT? There might be some older men listening to this podcast. Maybe they're in their 60s and 70s and they're like, oh, I don't want to do that HIIT because I might have a heart attack or something. Is there any risk to HIIT if you're older?
Yeah. So I would, you know, and to that specific example, no one has to do HIIT if they don't like it or prefer it, right? So there's a couple ways to look at this. Now, number one is if we look at the physical activity guidelines that generally recommend moderate to vigorous exercise in prescribed amounts, the suggestions or the recommendations are essentially the same for adults 18 to 64 and older adults 65 plus. Now, that's not saying that if you're 65 plus, you should explicitly do vigorous exercise or high intensity work. But again, when we look at the guidelines, adults of all ages are recommended to do vigorous intensity exercise. I think we clearly need to be mindful of chronic conditions, both musculoskeletal, and as people age, there tends to be increased potential silent risk factors, cardiovascular disease risk factors. And so, you know, the standard advice, of course, is that people should see their doctor if they're going to start or change an exercise regime. Start slowly, right? So if you're just getting into exercise, physical activity, start with the moderate stuff, then add the vigorous stuff. But also, people do not necessarily need to be afraid of vigorous exercise. And more people than we think, many more people than we think, can perform vigorous intensity exercise HIIT safely. And I think there's fairly compelling data in that regard. And definitely HIIT has been applied to individuals with many different chronic conditions, including cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, older individuals, people with cancer. So again, my take-home points, there are many more people than we think can do vigorous exercise, but of course, people need to be smart, ideally get checked out. And the older you get, you know, maybe back off on the sprint and all out stuff unless it's really suited to you and you're suited for it.
And you also point out, which is interesting, in the past 20, 30 years, cardiologists or heart hospitals, at first they're very leery of HIIT because they're treating people who had cardiac events, heart attacks, like, well, that's just going to hurt them even more. We don't want to do that because it's so stressful in the heart. But you're starting to see a lot of them incorporate that in the recovery process of heart attack patients. They're not going to do the all out 10 sprint, but they're getting their patients to do vigorous exercise in a supervised manner, because what the studies have found is that it helps strengthen these people's hearts that have gone through a heart attack.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and at one time, you know, rest was all that was prescribed after a heart attack. And at one time, you know, we wouldn't think that anyone who was a post-MI patient would lift a weight. And now we know that many cardiac rehab programs incorporate resistance training. And so I think it's the same with vigorous exercise. Ideally, it's properly supervised. But you know, and it depends across the world. Everyone's reading the same science, but, you know, for example, in Scandinavia, I think interval training is much more an accepted part of cardiac rehab practice. We're a little bit less, I would say, in North America. And, you know, and that's fine. But clearly, vigorous intensity exercise HIIT is being utilized widely in cardiac rehab.
Does HIIT raise your cortisol more than other forms of exercise?
Maybe a bit. You know, I'm less concerned, or I'm not convinced sort of these acute fluctuations in hormones post-exercise matter that much. And I don't think there's evidence that, for example, you have sustained rises in cortisol or other hormones that, you know, might be associated with muscle breakdown or stress. So I don't think it's something that people need to be concerned about.
So since your research has started, you've had other researchers in other fields look at HIIT, and you've had exercise psychologists look at HIIT. And one thing that some of these exercise psychologists are finding, that HIIT is a really effective way to get novice exercisers to start the exercise habit, which seems kind of counterintuitive because HIIT can be really unpleasant. And unpleasantness is one reason why people don't stick with an exercise plan. So have they figured out why is HIIT such an effective way to get beginning deconditioned exercisers to keep exercising?
Yeah, this is a real hornet's nest, I would say. And among the exercise psychology community, I'm not a behavioral expert, there are really polarizing opinions around the potential for HIIT as a public health strategy. And you're absolutely right. One camp would say, you know, if exercise is vigorous, if it's intense, people find it unpleasant. And so they're unlikely to do it. And so, you know, HIIT is bound to be a public health failure. I don't subscribe to that notion. And there's definitely a lot of exercise psychology, behavioral research coming out to suggest that, you know, okay, wait a minute. Brief, vigorous, intermittent exercise, it's completely different from continuous vigorous exercise. It also depends, when are you asking people the question? You know, if you ask them during the bout, they might rate HIIT a little bit lower, but after the bout, they're like, you know what? Didn't take me as long. I'm getting the same benefit. I'll take that. And there was a recent meta-analysis based on over 100 studies, almost 9,000 participants that found similar rates of measures like compliance and adherence to high intensity interval training and moderate intensity continuous training, so such that those were not different. So I think, you know, you can cherry pick individual studies. And for the critics of HIIT, I would say, well, you know, what's the fallback? Because we know that the adherence to the broad public health adherence to moderate exercises is not very great. And so to demonize any form of physical activity doesn't make sense to me if arguably we're all in the same team here and we agree that the biggest thing that we need to do is just get more people active and more people moving. You know, again, coming back to this idea, the more exercise options, the better. Let's expand that movement menu rather than sort of demonize one particular approach.
I think one point a psychologist made was that when you take a deconditioned person, someone who hasn't exercised, and then put them on the path to run a 5K, when they're first starting, they're doing interval training but unintentionally, because they can only like run maybe a few hundred feet and then they got to stop and walk and then they catch the breath and they start. Like they might, in the person's head, they think they're doing steady state cardio and they think they're failing because they're not running the entire time. It's like, no, actually you're just doing interval training. That's fine. You're getting all these great health benefits doing that.
100%. You know, it's sort of like changing the narrative or flipping it on its head. And it can be a very empowering way to exercise. It's like, no, wait a minute. You're not a failure because you can't sustain a pace for 30 minutes. You're training like Olympic champions. That's what they do. They sort of go hard, they take a break, and they do it again. So, you know, that's completely okay. And so I think if you're looking for buy-in or that, rather than telling someone they're a failure because they can't do 20, 30 minutes continuous because their starting capacity is so low, saying, hey, an intermittent approach, it works just fine. So, you know, keep it up.
I love that. Okay. So the HIIT workout, you're not saying that it's better than or steady state cardio. It's another option to choose from in your fitness repertoire. So if you don't have time for an hour long zone two cardio session, just do a 10 minute interval workout and you get all these benefits in terms of aerobic metabolism, cardiovascular health, insulin, diabetes, weight loss. You get all those benefits with just maybe 10 minutes of work.
I think that's how people should look at it. It's an option. It's a particularly time efficient option. It's not necessarily the best or for everybody, but definitely work it into your fitness menu.
All right. Well, let's talk about some HIIT workouts that people can do. So after listening to this episode, they'll do some or have that as an option. What are the type of movements you can do for HIIT?
Almost anything. So I, you know, again, getting back to this idea of your heart doesn't know what your muscles are doing, again, generally speaking, I don't think it matters. And our research would suggest it wouldn't matter if it's indoor-based cycling, if it's stair climbing exercise, if it's uphill, if it's bodyweight style exercise, all of those things can be utilized effectively as an interval training workout to stimulate improvements in all of those metrics that we were talking about there. So I don't think, and again, we're talking general health improvement here. You know, if you're an athlete, you try to train very sport specifically. And so if you're a cyclist, you better train with interval cycling to try and get better. But, you know, for most people, that's not the key driver. They just want to enhance their cardiorespiratory fitness and other health metrics. And so probably varying it up is is a good strategy, but the specific type of movement doesn't matter so much.
Just whatever you like, whatever you enjoy doing.
Correct.
Yeah. So what's a good interval workout for, I get to say, a rank beginner?
Yeah. So two ways to answer this question. One is, you know, probably you want to get out of your comfort zone, but again, you're not doing this all out 9 or 10 on a 10 point scale exercise. And so, you know, if your standard exercise is walking around the block or continuous moderate exercise at about a 5 there, you know, in getting out of your comfort zone, start with a 6, maybe get into a 7 and, you know, do that for a minute or so and then back off. But classic examples would be, you know, 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off. And there's a ton of research, much of it out of Japan, that has looked at this interval walking as a strategy and just showing the tremendous benefits that that can elicit. Again, we're just talking brisk walking here. Another classic protocol largely developed in Norway is the 4x4. So that's 4 4-minute efforts at a relatively high in intensity. And then, you know, you go from there. And what tends to happen is the intensity goes up and the duration of the intervals goes down. So we've looked at, you know, a 10x1 protocol. And so, you know, how hard you're working there for a minute is harder than the 4-minute protocol. But again, you're only doing a minute, not four of it, right? And you repeat that in a sort of on-off pattern. And I think that's also one of the beauties of interval training is the infinite variety. People say, what's the best interval training protocol on it? I don't think it matters, right? Again, generally speaking, unless you're an athlete training for a very specific performance outcome, for most of us, it doesn't matter. And hopefully that's empowering. And hopefully, you know, it takes away the boredom a little bit because, you know, vary up the intervals. There's only so many ways to get on a treadmill and jog at a moderate pace for an hour or so. But with intervals, you can really vary it up, intensity, duration of both work, recovery periods, all of that.
That Japanese protocol, is that the Tabata protocol?
No, it would sort of be one over the Tabata protocol. So there has been some classic interval training work out of Japan, almost at the ends of the spectrum. So that 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off, that's just very much brisk or interval walking. Whereas Professor Izumi Tabata is, you know, the father of Tabata intervals. That's at the complete other end of the spectrum. And that's, you know, 20 seconds at a 10 out of 10 pace, right? As hard as you can go. 10-second recovery, and then you do it again 8 times. So, you know, a Tabata workout classically lasts 4 minutes, 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, repeated 8 times. But a Tabata workout is one of the most challenging interval protocols that you can do.
Okay, so yeah, the key takeaway there is the more intense you go, the shorter your workout can be, but the less intense, if you're doing just a walk, your intervals will have to be longer, and so your workout overall will take longer.
That's right. You know, at the end of the day, there's no free lunch, right? And so if you definitely want the benefits of brief exercise, it needs to be intense. And that's not necessarily for everyone. And at the other end of the spectrum, you can still do interval training. It doesn't have to be this all out as hard as you can go. But, you know, you're invested then for a couple of minutes and repeating that at least, you know, 3, 4, 5 times.
One you highlight that I like is the Wingate Classic. What's that one about?
Yeah, so the Wingate is sort of a classic test in exercise physiology. It's also known as the Wingate anaerobic test, going back to our earlier discussion. And that's because it's 30 seconds as hard as you can go. And it's actually performed on a specialized bike or a specialized ergometer that sort of gives back just what you're able to put out. And so, you know, even as you're fatiguing, you're still having to go. It's about the longest 30 seconds of your life. And so our initial work was utilizing a Wingate protocol as sort of the extreme, right? It was a proof of concept studies at the time. And so people would do these protocols where it took, you know, 4, 5, 6 of those Wingates with a few minutes in between. These were very, very demanding workouts. And, you know, it's almost a variation on a Tabata workout. And then over time, we've sort of dropped the overall time, dropped the overall intensity, and looked at other protocols.
Yeah, you have it's the 10x1 is your variation of the Wingate.
That's right. And again, you know, all different protocols appeal to different people, but probably if I had to pick one that seems to be widely suited or widely rated as not bad, it's this 10x1 protocol, you know, almost seemingly hits that sweet spot between it. You know, the intervals are not too long, but they're not too hard either. At least they're not all out. And then more recent research by others has shown that, you know, 5x1 can be almost as good as 10x1. And so it's a bit like, you know, bench press exercise. You know, three sets of bench, you're going to be better than one set, but, you know, maybe only 5% better. You know, so if you do one set of heavy bench, you might improve your strength by 25 or 30%. If you do three sets, maybe you're going to do 35 or 40%. But again, if you're time pressed, that one set might be enough. And so, you know, maybe a few intervals are giving you 80, 90% of the benefit that, you know, a much larger dose of intervals might do.
Right. So yeah, the 10 by one, just for listeners, your first sprint is at an intensity of 5. You do that for a minute, then you rest 1 minute for recovery. Then your second sprint is going to be at a slightly higher intensity level, so 6. Do that for a minute. And then you just keep that cycle going until you get to an intensity level of 9.
That's right. And so, you know, one of the reasons we came up with that is because, you know, for a lot of people, they're not outside trying to, you know, tailor their specific, you know, intensities or that. You can imagine if you're exercising on a machine or you jump on a stationary bike, it allows you to set a workload and just leave it there, right? For the intervals. So, you know, whatever, if it's a 20-point scale and you dial it up to a 12, the first minute at 12 only feels like a 5 out of 10. But of course, as you start to fatigue over the course of the workout, you're still at a 12, but the relative effort starts to creep up. And so again, it's a way to make it sort of simple. Okay, I'm going to just keep it at a 12, but it's going to feel harder and harder each time as I move through the workout.
So your book is called The 1 Minute Workout. It's a catchy title. I'm sure the publisher, your editor's like, we got to call this The 1 Minute Workout because it's going to sell books. But is there a workout that lasts about a minute that can give you all these health benefits we've been talking about?
So yes, and I'll get to that in a minute, but you're right. The 1 minute workout, sort of a tongue in cheek, but it was based on some of these micro workouts where we're having people do 3 20-second hard efforts. Now, you know, the workout took about 10 minutes start to finish, but the hard stuff was only a minute, 3 20-second efforts interspaced with a lot of recovery in between. Why I say a minute could be good is now we're starting to look at what we call exercise snacks. And so how we define an exercise snack is a vigorous bout of exercise that lasts for a minute or less. And you do these periodically throughout the day. So you can imagine on your way to work in the morning, you do a 1 minute vigorous effort. You know, maybe you come into work, you take the stairs rather than the elevator. As you're leaving at night for the subway, you know, you exercise at a vigorous pace to get to the subway rather than a pedestrian pace. And so that's known as an exercise snack, and you sprinkle these through the day. And definitely in small laboratory-based studies, if people do that a few times a week for a couple of weeks, we can see measurable improvements in their cardiorespiratory fitness. That work, this small-scale lab work, is complemented by some other work that I've been involved with, led out of the University of Sydney, where the terminology, and again, you alluded to it earlier, there's, you know, it's almost an alphabet soup when we start talking about this, but the notion is vigorous, intermittent lifestyle physical activity, or VILPA. But if we break that down, so vigorous is the effort that you require, and hopefully your listeners have a good idea what vigorous is by now. Intermittent, so it's periodic, spread throughout the day, and it's lifestyle physical activity. This is not structured exercise that you build into your calendar. This is as you're going about your day. You know, you're leaving work, you got to get to the subway. You can get there at a vigorous pace or at a pedestrian pace. You know, you get off a long flight, you have the choice of the escalator, or you can, you know, grab your built-in workout gear, your suitcase, and you can walk up the stairs, and that takes you about a minute. That would be an example of VILPA, carrying a heavy backpack as you're doing your shopping. And research, again, that I was involved with in a very large sample, over 25,000 individuals who had worn accelerometers, showed that as little as 3 to 4 minutes of accumulated VILPA per day was associated with marked reductions in all-cause mortality. We're talking 30% reductions as compared to people who engaged in no vigorous intensity physical activity through the day. And the risk reduction was even greater for cardiovascular disease. So I think compelling, not cause and effect evidence, but compelling epidemiological evidence that small amounts of vigorous physical activity can really move the needle in terms of enhancing our health. And so, you know, I've just talked about there about larger epidemiological evidence, small laboratory-based studies, and where our research is moving now is sort of trying to round out the middle there. Larger, longer, randomized controlled trials where we're trying to look at this type of lifestyle intervention and see, you know, how does it work when we try and use a best practice design with control groups and things like that.
All right. So the takeaway there, take the stairs.
Absolutely. Take the stairs. A few minutes of vigorous effort a day really, really pays benefits. And it feeds into the notion that every little bit counts.
Well, Martin, this has been a great conversation. Is there some place people can go to learn more about the book and your work?
Yeah, sure. So I do have a website, martingabala.com, and sort of that's a one-stop shop for, you know, other podcast interviews like this. People learn about the book. People learn about a free online course that some colleagues and I at McMaster offer. I'm not on X a lot, but you can find me at Gabala M.
Fantastic. Well, Martin Gabala, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
My guest today was Dr. Martin Gabala. He's the author of the book, The 1 Minute Workout. It's available on Amazon.com. Check out his website at martingabala.com where you can find more information about his work. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/hit, and that's spelled HIIT. You'll find links to resources, including links to more details about how to do some of those specific HIIT protocols we talked about towards the end of the show. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Make sure to check out our website at artofmanliness.com where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles that we've written over the years about pretty much anything you think of. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member you think we get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you to not listen to AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action. We'll